outline of this morning's lesson. Does that mean anything to you? To some, it will mean something because they have spent time in a certain Old Testament book. To some of us, perhaps, it is gibberish, meaningless collocation of letters. But it is a significant message. One of the great historical messages. So much so that it is passed into the language of our culture. When we sometimes say about somebody, he hasn't read the handwriting on the wall. Or we may say, you need to read the handwriting on the wall. Perhaps you've used that language. Perhaps you've heard that language used and you had no idea about its origin. This is what was written on that ancient wall in the palace of a Babylonian king. And what we have in the fifth chapter of Daniel is a living parable that speaks soberly about the fact that life has its end. And that at the end of life, there will be judgment, there will be consequence, there will be evaluation. That we just don't live here meaninglessly and then end it all. I invite you to take up the book of Daniel. Perhaps you haven't spent time in it of late. I could tell you that this is the most well-known, perhaps in some ways, story in it. We know the exact day, virtually, of this event that is recorded here. The old empires of the Middle East are dying. They are making one last effort to live. But a new and more vital kingdom is rising in the East. And the days of Great Babylon are numbered. I suppose what makes this scene in the fifth chapter of Daniel so striking is the contrast between two figures that are present on this occasion. I suppose of one we might say there could hardly be a more godly figure. I suspect that the king of Babylon is not old. His father is still living. He was a co-regent with his father, who was even at this particular time living in Arabia, where he had taken the army of Babylon and conquered a great city and then just stayed there the rest of his life, and he left his son, Belshazzar, to reign in the capital. But all the while this is going on, there's a man by the name of Cyrus, who's the king of the Persians, who had in 550 B.C. conquered the Medes and added that kingdom to his own. In response, the kings of Babylon, and the king of Lydia, whose name happened to be Croesus. Ever heard of Croesus? Sometimes we say rich as Croesus. And a king of Greece had united against Persia, and Cyrus just went over and wiped out the king of Lydia and took his empire. And now Babylon is before him. But down in the capital in Babylon, nobody is alarmed. And nobody is concerned. There's not the slightest sense that disaster is about to fall. No idea that the armies of Persia will soon be leaping upon this kingdom like a lion upon its prey. And so here we have it. Belshazzar and 1,000 of his lords, with his wives and his concubines, having a banquet, eating and drinking and making merry. And the interesting thing, and the awful thing is, that they were drinking their wine and getting into a state of drunkenness with the cups, the sacred vessels that Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem when he had razed the city in 586 B.C. I mean, this is the ultimate indignity. And not only that, but to add to the tragedy, they take those cups and drink their wine, and they drink a toast to the gods. Verse 4 says, of gold and of silver and of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. They use the sacred vessels that were for the use of the priests alone and that for the sacrifice of adoration and praise to the great God of the universe. And they make light of it. I think about the world I live in when I read this story. We drink our lives and treat with the greatest contempt the most sacred things. We enjoy ourselves to the full. America enjoying itself to the full. There is no eroticism too extreme. There is no cruel brutality that we wouldn't entertain it. And our lips are filled with profanity as we treat with utter contempt all the sacred thoughts that have to do with the eternal God. And we don't think for one single moment that disaster could be around the corner. The idea hasn't entered the mind, I suspect, of many who rule in this land, that everything could collapse in total chaos. But it could. Verse 5 says, in the same hour came forth the fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. And then the king's countenance was changed in him, and his thoughts troubled him, and the joints of his loins were loosed, and his knees struck one against the other. Certainly a change of mood, isn't there? And I suspect if suddenly in the middle of this meeting this morning, a hand, mystic, began to write on this wall, the mood might change here. As reverent as we might be. Sometimes people come to assemblies like this and there is no thought of God. There's a thought of everything else. Minds are busy and occupied. Too busy, too occupied, too frantic with other things to be focused upon eternal values, to be focused upon transcendent things. Our lives have not been characterized by much focus on those things. We come to this place for a reality check, the truth is. The stimuli that bombards us day after day in the world in which we live does not stir us to think long thoughts. There's immediacy about it. What I'm going to do about this problem now, what I'm going to do to deal with my obligations financially, what I'm going to do to deal with and to help find some peace of mind in my personal relationship. What I'm going to do about these things that are just in front of my face, these are the things that occupy us. And we don't tend to look ahead. But we need to. And we ought to. Recognizing that life proceeds to some end. Even if we don't recognize that that end is the one described in the scripture. But he was terrified, I think. He had been so bold and so brazen and so confident and so assured before. And all his companions with him. Within those four walls, everything was under control. Within those four walls, everything was in his charge. Within those four walls, with the wealth of the empire at his disposal, he was exulting. There is a Jewish myth that I could not for a single moment give any credence to, but it was included in the writing of a commentary by Jerome on the book of Daniel in the 4th century A.D. That myth is, that tradition is, that this was a celebration on the part of the king of Babylon for the failure of the prophecy of Jeremiah. He had said 70 years, and the people who are carried away into captivity by Nebuchadnezzar and his predecessors are going to be released and go back home. And so according to this tradition, and it's just that, they were all there celebrating the fact that Jeremiah's prophecy failed. If that were the case, and I doubt it, let me say that the celebration took place one day too soon. And that's true of so many of our confident declarations. Everything is fine. Things are working out just as I hoped. If I'd ever had a concern about life going wrong because of this conduct or this attitude or that attitude, everything is all right. But it wasn't all right. Verse 25 of the chapter says, "And this is the writing that was inscribed, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin." This is the interpretation of the thing. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you are weighed in the balance and are found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Now, he couldn't read that writing. It may have been some ancient Aramaic that was no longer spoken by this nation. Some have speculated that the Hebrews, who had some linguistic similarities in their language with that ancient Aramaic, might have been able to read it. I don't know. The one thing is certain is that the one who did read it was given the power to do so by God. When the king is frightened by the words on the wall, he starts calling for his soothsayers. Get the wise men in here. We got to have some instruction about what this means. Obviously, when something this mysterious and this supernatural occurs, you want to have some explanation of what's going on. And he brings them all in and he says, "Now, I want to tell you fellows at the beginning, if you're able to give me an explanation and to read this writing on the wall, I will clothe you in purple, put a gold chain around your neck, and you'll be third in the kingdom." Now, third in the kingdom? What's that? Well, Nabonidus, the father of Belshazzar, was the actual ruler. That is to say, he was the ruler of record. He was the king of record. But the de facto ruler of Babylon was Belshazzar because his father had left him to take care of the affairs of state. Now, it's interesting that for the longest period of time, critics of the Bible said, this whole thing is a myth. We have no record of anybody named Belshazzar, king of Babylon. And they like to collect those things, but let me warn you about that kind of overconfidence, which characterizes critics of the Scripture. The woods are full of men who have confidently affirmed that this never happened. There's not a bit of evidence anywhere that anything like this took place. But unfortunately for them, and fortunately for us. The archaeologists kept digging around for purposes of their own over there in the Middle East and came up with a lot of clay tablets that had been baked after they had been inscribed with a little stylus that's called the cuneiform. It's a wedge-shaped stylus, and that's the way they wrote in those days. And what they came up with was an inscription that had been written by Nabonidus, whom they thought was the last king of Babylon, and they laughed about Belshazzar. And Nabonidus said that this, as he prayed to the gods for his son, his firstborn son, whose name was Belshazzar. Well, back to the drawing boards. It never has discouraged the critics of the Bible to find out that again and again what they've said was not true is true. But he said, I'll make you third ruler in the kingdom. Not a very grand reward given what was about to happen. You and I ought to think about the rewards we're getting for the life we're living as to whether or not they have any prospect at all of being worth a hill of beans. I'll tell you one thing. A purple robe and a gold chain and being third ruler of Babylon not going to mean anything after this night is over. Not anything. We don't weigh the future like we ought to. Well, the wise men would have loved to have had a gold chain around their necks and a purple robe, and of all things to be coveted, to be next in line to Belshazzar in the kingdom of Babylon, glorious golden Babylon. They wanted that badly, but it didn't make any difference because they had no clue as to what those words on the wall were up there by the chandelier, by the candlestick. Yes, it appeared in the brightest spot in the hall. And they couldn't read it. And the queen said, don't worry. There is a man in your kingdom, Belshazzar, who can interpret the words on the wall. For in the days of your father Nebuchadnezzar, and that's been another criticism. His father was not Nebuchadnezzar, they say. He was the son of Nabonidus. That's true. But in the sense of ancestry, Nabonidus, though he was not in line to be king and seized it by force 7 years after the death of Nebuchadnezzar, nonetheless was of the family of Nebuchadnezzar. And so in that sense, he was his father in ancestry, perhaps. But even if not that, he was the father of Belshazzar, having been king before him. And I think that's the sense in which it's used. And she says there was a man in whom was the spirit of the holy God. She's a pagan. They're all pagans. This is a heathen feast they're involved in. It is pagan to the core. And the spirit of the holy God is in this man. And he was able to explain mysteries, and you need to send for him because Nebuchadnezzar made him the chief of the magicians. And so Daniel is brought in. I want you to get the picture here. I want you to know what to look for. 539 A.D. it was. In the fall of the year. And Daniel had been carried into captivity to Babylon in 606 as a young prince. I don't know. We are never told how old Daniel was when he came. When he said to himself in that strange land away from all his people, I will not defile myself with the king's dainties. When he chose for his companions the finest young men among those princes. Young men of courage and of conviction and of commitment. But if he was 16, if he were 16, he is now 77 years old. You're not looking on some young, vital, 40-year-old, 45-year-old, 50-year-old man who comes in the strength of his years to make some declaration to this royal personage. You're looking upon an aged man. And he's called upon to interpret the words and told, as were all the rest, that I will give you the purple robe and the gold chain and third ruler in the kingdom. And Daniel says, keep your gifts. You give gifts to yourself. I have no need of that, but I will interpret the words. I will interpret the words. And so he did. But before he does, he gives him a lesson of history and preaches a sermon. This is a 77-year-old man or an 80-year-old man or a 75-year-old man who has no fear whatsoever of Belshazzar. He had no fear of Nebuchadnezzar. He will have no fear of enemies yet to come in the fullness of his years. And the reason for that is there was such a total reverence in him for God. And such a total understanding and complete realization that it's God who rules in the kingdoms of men. And men like Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar appear like shadows upon the scene of history for a brief time, and they have no control virtually of that moment, little control of that moment, and none of the future. None. And so he says, well, verse 18, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the kingdom. And he ruled over many nations. Because the great God gave him the power to do it. But then, verse 20 says, when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was deposed from the kingly throne. And then he tells the story of that 7 years of madness, utter madness. The king of Babylon eating grass like an ox somewhere, utterly out of his mind. Who finally came to himself after that and knew and said, you can read it in this book, that the Most High God rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whomever he will. Nebuchadnezzar was humbled by his experience. But now to the man before them, verse 22, and you, his son, O Belshazzar, you have not humbled your heart. Though you knew all this, but have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of brass, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see, nor hear, nor know, and the God in whose hand your breath is, and whose are all your ways, you have not glorified. That's an indictment. You knew all that happened to Nebuchadnezzar. You could read the annals of the king. Those events have come down to you. You realize that. And yet, meant nothing. You don't suppose we could be indicted with it? That we've been exposed to a lot of sobering events ourselves. And we've seen other people take the wrong course and suffer the consequence of it. And we've looked on, we said, not me. Not me. And my family won't break into a million pieces. I won't watch my children enter into some sort of profoundly miserable marriages. I won't watch my grandchildren walk in worldly, ungodly. It won't happen to me, not me. Maybe you. Maybe me if I'm not careful. And now the lesson. He says, mene, numbered. Numbered. God has numbered your kingdom and brought it to an end. We have an expression, do we not? Your days are numbered. And they are, you know. Life is not infinite. Human life has its limits. And our days are numbered. I'm not suggesting to you that there's some sort of fated day when you're supposed to die. But I'm telling you, your days and my days, they are numbered. And the days of this kingdom, they have been numbered, he said. The days of this world are numbered. They're like an hourglass, the upper chamber of which has been covered. You can look and see in the lower chamber how many days have passed. You know about that. You and I know how old we are. But what we do not know is how many grains are in the upper chamber. And what remains. Luke 12. Remember the story Jesus told in verse 13 about a certain farmer. There had been a man listening to all his words of greatness, and the only thing he could think about while Jesus was discussing eternity and holiness and purity in the kingdom of God and how we ought to live in the time that's given us, only thing he could think about was, my brother is not treating me fairly. He's taken my part of the inheritance. He's stolen from me, and he needs to be told by somebody to share fairly. Well, there wasn't anything wrong necessarily with wanting fairness. But let me tell you what was wrong. What was wrong was that was the passion of his life. It was the concern of his heart. He was driven by it. All the rest of life was colored by it. He couldn't see anything else for the fact that his brother had not properly and fairly divided the inheritance. And I have seen that happen today. And the Lord said to him, man, who made me a divider over you, when he asked Jesus to bid his brother to behave justly. And then he told him a story about a certain farmer whose field brought forth wonderfully. And he brought in the harvest. And he had to tear down his barns. He said, I'll tear down these barns. I'll build bigger barns. And when it's all put in there, I'll say to myself, soul, take your ease. You have much good for many years. Eat, drink. Fool, the voice said, this night is your soul required of you, and who shall these things be? Life is numbered. It doesn't go on endlessly. Every life has its limit. Jesus said in John 9 and verse 4, in connection with some observations about the blind man that they met there in the city of Jerusalem, said, we must work the works of him that sent me while it is day, for the night comes when no man can work. The night is coming. The last day of our life will come. And likely when it does come, it will be like any other day. Even if we're in an illness, we always think, you know, not today. To put off duty is to fail. James chapter 4. Where our practically minded preacher is talking about folk who make their plans with utter disregard for possibilities that it may never happen. Utter disregard for the fact that we don't control all the factors of our lives. Chapter 4, verse 13. Come now, you that say, today or tomorrow we'll go into this city and spend a year there and trade and get gain, whereas you do not know what will be on the morrow. What is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. For that you ought to say, if the Lord wills. If the Lord will, we shall both live and do this or that. But now you glory in your vauntings, all such glorying is evil. Now get the statement that's last that seems almost disconnected. To him, therefore, that knows to do good and does it not, to him it is sin. to those who know what needs to be done today, to those who recognize their duty, to those who understand full well what life is about and do not do it, this passage says that is sinful. Belshazzar, Daniel said, had a duty to serve the living God. That was his duty. But he did not fulfill it. And if he had a thought in his mind that someday he might do that, and perhaps he had, I don't know, whether back in the back of that pagan intelligence there was some sort of feeling that one of these days I probably need to straighten things up here. That wasn't on his mind this festive night when he had everything that he thought was grand gathered around him and he was just savoring it to the last. You have a duty to serve God. And I have a duty to serve God. And you don't have to volunteer for it. It's not just those who say, okay, I'll be one. And then because you volunteered, you ought to keep your commitment. No, that's not it. You were born to this duty. Acts chapter 17. Speaking of God, Paul says to the Athenians, he made of one every nation of men to dwell upon the face of the earth, having determined their appointed seasons and the bounds of their habitation. And by the way, that very verse is thought by many students of the Scripture to have reference to the length of time that kingdoms will stand. That God will decide how long this kingdom will last and when it will terminate. That He rules in the kingdoms of men. But He says He made of one every nation of men to dwell upon the face of the earth. For what intention? That they might seek God. If happy, they might feel after him and find. That to a group of pagans, yes, and there were gods of gold and silver and wood and stone on the hillsides in Athens just covering up the place. And he said, God has made the world. He does not dwell in temples made with hands. And he's not served by men's hands. He gives you life and breath and all things. And his intention for you is that you should seek him. And that's your duty. And when you don't fulfill it, that's sin. Sin to Belshazzar. And to sin to us. It's going to end. Our days are numbered. We know that. The next word, mene, tika. Numbered. Now, weighed in the balances. In a balanced scale. That's what's being talked about here. Not only is the time gone, Belshazzar, but you're going to be faced with the God who created you. And you're going to be weighed in the balances of heaven. The Egyptians, in their tombs, often had a hieroglyph of a balance scale in which the symbol of a man's soul is on one side and the symbol for truth is on the other. Even these pagans believed there'd be judgment. They likely had no concept of the nature of it. But they knew that. And even Belshazzar, with his knees striking together on this particular night, had some sense of foreboding. And I have great suspicion that as those words were written there and as he began to think some long thoughts that he hadn't thought for a long time, that he was sobered by the conviction that just perhaps this is the day when I'm going to have to face my life. And what Daniel said this word meant is, you have been weighed in the balance scale and found wanting. Now let me tell you that I am convinced that this man had done committed a lot of wickedness. I don't doubt he had done about whatever a man can do. As a violation of the prohibitions of God's moral law. But what is said here in this statement is found wanting, something missing here. I want to remind you that that's the tragedy of many lives. Not what we have gone out and positively committed against the prohibitions of God, but there are those. But maybe there haven't been many like that. Maybe. But let me tell you, the rich young ruler came to Jesus in the 19th chapter of Matthew and said, What do I need to do to inherit or to have eternal life? And the Lord said, keep the commandments. And he mentioned some of them. And the young man said, but I've done this since I was a youth. What do I lack yet? Or another record of it says, one thing you lack. Go and sell all that you have. Something is wanting. What is wanting here? You have not done what you ought to have done with what you have. Your wealth is your God. You have stored the stuff up even while you're keeping all these other commandments and holding back from God the one thing where your heart is, and you are wanting. You are weighed in the balances at this moment and you have found wanting. He had time. But he didn't have an inclination, so he walked away. What happened later, we never told. Weighed in the balances, found wanting. Remember those words in Romans chapter 3, verse 23? Oft cited. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Come short. That is to say, we've not met our responsibility. We've not fulfilled our duty to God. Yes, of course, there's sin in violating God's prohibitions, wickedness in that, certainly. But that's not the only way you can go to hell. There are plenty of ways to go to hell by simply not doing what you should have done. And you can sit down all day and protest, I didn't do anything. And that may be your indictment. He didn't do anything. Falling short of God's expectation, of what He expects from men, and has every right to expect from us. Remember the 25th chapter of Matthew and that judgment scene where the Son of God sits upon the throne of His glory and men are brought before Him and He separates them like a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. Do you remember the indictment? In every case, those who are put on His left hand and rejected are rejected because of what they did not do. Are you listening to me? Some of us are asleep. We're just cruising along like Belshazzar, and we think everything tomorrow is going to be just like it is today, and things are going to turn out right no matter what we fail to do. No matter our neglect of daily spiritual pursuits, no matter our failure to teach and train our children, no matter our failure to be concerned preeminently and passionately about the things that matter above all else, that somehow or another somebody, some faithful force will just come in and work everything out because I'm a good individual. You are not good when you fail to do what you ought to have done, when your duty has not been fulfilled. Speak not about what you have not done to violate the will of God. The absence of immorality in your life. On our walls, and this is a fearful thought for me, as I have said several times before this audience and many times to myself, the thing I fear in this time in my life is not that I'll go out and violate some awful moral prohibition, though I have a concern for that. I hope I'm not stupid enough to think that I could never do anything like that. But I tell you, my deepest concern is that I will have failed to do and to be all that I have every cause to know God expects me to do and to be. And then the last. Your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Perez, he says. That's not the same as Euphorson, isn't it? Well, it's the root word, doubtless. The root word that means divided. You're stripped of all you have. all these manifestations of wealth, all this glory of your kingdom is gone. There's a penalty, you see. It's not just, well, you didn't do well, and that's, it's over. For judgment, judgment brings reward and punishment. You can't read the scripture without getting a sense of that. That life is not just something that is lived and that's it. But life is something that's lived and then it's judged and then there's a consequence. What he had been given, he misused. Didn't use it to glorify God, used it to glorify himself and to fulfill his own agenda. What do you suppose the appropriate punishment would be for somebody who receives the great gift from God? God set him upon the throne, just like he had Nebuchadnezzar, his predecessor, and then he misused it. And not only did he not do what he ought to have done, but he had a deep contempt for things divine that was almost unbounded. Drink out of the cups, so we may show contempt for the God of the Hebrews. And raise our glasses to the greatness of the gods of gold and silver and stone and wood. And serve selfishness and irreverence. Well, maybe take away your life and give you death. Take away goodness and give you torment and evil. Take away peace and give you anguish and gnashing of teeth. It's about such things as this that Jesus speaks when he warns us. Don't go to that place. Kingdoms are judged in history. Proverbs 14:34 says, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. We are a reproached people in this country. We are a reproached people. And there's nothing we fear so much as the people who are concerned for the lack of moral values among us. These are the ones to be feared. The religious right, I read an article recently that punctured this myth that is some sort of monolithic group of mad people who are crazy with their desire to force their rules upon everybody else. Of course, studies show that's not true. Just a group of people from all quarters of this country who have a concern that we are falling into a morass of mindless immorality. No standards, no rules, except what I want, my right, and my freedom to do whatever I please. This nation will be judged too, in history. But our concern this morning is the judgment of people. Each of us has been given a life to live, and time to live it well and wisely. And we have before us the example of one who at age 33 years old. I'm already 30 years past that. And when he died, he was able to say, "It is finished. What I came to do, I have achieved." It is important for us to be able to say that about our lives. And not to continue the mindless procrastination that I don't know was in the mind of Belshazzar, but if it was, he procrastinated one day too long. The parable of the talents tells us that if we don't use what God has given us to serve him, it'll be taken away from us and given to another. Take away the talent that was given to the man with one and give it to the man that has 10. He did something with what he had. The parable of the fig tree and the vineyard in the 13th chapter of Luke. That was found barren, doing nothing, cumbering the ground. And the vineyard owner said, "Take that tree and dig it up and get it out of here." And the keeper of the vineyard said, "No, let me dig around it and cultivate it and fertilize it and see if we can get something done. And then, if nothing happens, then we'll do that. The time will run out on a fruitless life." And the fig tree cursed by the Son of God was a parable too, a living one. When on Monday morning he speaks to the fig tree that made every promise by the presence of leaves upon it, that there were figs to eat and there were none, and he said, "Never bear again." And the next day it was a dead, dry stalk. Jesus, in the 15th chapter of the Gospel of John, says, fruitless branches, those branches in me that bear no fruit, will be cut off. They'll be cast away. They'll be put into the fire. In Matthew 7:19, in the Sermon on the Mount, every tree that bears not good fruit shall be hewn down and cast into the fire. October 29th, 539 B.C., Babylon fell. Greek historians record that the Persian army diverted the river that ran under the walls of the city of Babylon, from which they had a secure source of water, or so they thought, and having diverted the stream, were able to go on the riverbed under the walls. It was a bloodless victory. They had the city before the city knew it had been had. This night, said Daniel, your kingdom is taken from you and given to others. What about us? That's what we must think of. David said in 8th Psalm, verses 4 to 6, that God has put all things under our feet, given us to be ruler over everything in this created universe. And that's what he said to Adam and Eve in the beginning. Put all things in subjection under our feet. But then Hebrews 2:6-9 says that though that statement is made, we don't yet see all things made subject to him. Men do not rule. And the reason they do not rule is because they are ruled over.